So yeah, my name is Avishai Galian. I'm a postdoc at Caltech, and I'm working on supernovae of all kinds and also gamma ray bursts, mostly on core collapse supernovae, but today I'm speaking on type 1As, surprisingly. So let's start. New observation clues for progenitors of type 1As. This is a project that we've been working on at Caltech. My main collaborator there is Josh Simon and Doug Leonard, who now moved to San Diego. And a lot of the work I'm going to show is actually done and is going to be published by Nando Patat and the collaborators from ESO and other places in Europe. So, this is a very specialized workshop, so I'm going to be very brief on introductions. I'm mainly going to try to convince you that there could be a new, or I'm not sure it's that new, but something that's not been tried in the last few years, a new observational route to get some idea about the progenitors directly. So the main thing I'm going to discuss is whether type 1As are coming from a single degenerate or double degenerate root, so whether the mass donor is degenerate and otherwise dwarf or not. And then if it's not, then, well, what is it? So the easy thing observationally to test is whether the mass donor is non-degenerate, because then you expect that there maybe there will be some mass loss, either from the accretion process or from the donor, and you can try to get some observational detection of that, because detecting the system itself outside of our galaxy is rather hopeless because it's so faint before it explodes. So the best limits I found are in the radio from work by Nino Panagia and collaborators, that from the lack of radio detection after the supernovae explode, put a very strict upper limit on the mass loss from the system. And there are additional limits from the X-rays by Inder and others. And then people have for a long time been looking for optical lines, other absorption or emission lines of hydrogen or helium in the spectra of bright supernovae. And they also get some limits which are weaker than the other ones. There are some underlying assumptions about these radio and X-ray limits, about what the mass losses exactly look like. So these are not very strict, but this is more or less what we have. Let's say that for a normal type 1A, there's never been a detection of circumstellar material. Most of what I'm going to show you are observations of 2006X, a type 1A supernova in a Virgo spiral galaxy, M100, that was actually discovered during the previous KITP supernova workshop, a little bit more than a year ago. And I remember sitting in the crowd with Skyler Van Dyke, working very intensively on his laptop, trying to find out the progenitor of the supernova before we knew it's a 1A, because this is a nearby galaxy, there's lots of pre-explosion imaging. But it's a 1A, and there's, of course, no massive star that you can see there. And then it was discovered rather early, well before maximum light, which is nice. Immediately it was clear from the first spectra and then later on from photometry that there's a substantial extinction towards the supernova. There's a lot of dust on the line of sight, and we'll show that in a minute. I don't know why the image went away, but this is the supernova. These are images from the VLT. It's a little bit of an overkill for a 13 magnitude supernova, but still a nice picture. And it sits near a spiral arm of the galaxy. And from our analysis, it looks like it's actually on the other side of the disk of this galaxy. And then there were no prompt detections either in radio or X-rays to limits that are as good as the one I cited before. Okay, so the VLA looked at this almost immediately. Okay. The observation I'm going to describe are high-resolution observations, so really high resolution, with the UVS instruments on VLT and high-res on KEK. And these are the the epoch relative to B-band maximum. Most of the data is from DD approved by submitted by Nando Patat and approved. And then we had some additional data. And this is what the data look like if you zoom in on the area around the sodium D2 lines. Okay, this is a very small portion of the spectrum. And one thing I would like to impress you immediately on this panel is that there are changes with time, as you can see there. Let's see if this works. Yes. So what we see here, we see a very strong and saturated component, which comes from the disk of the galaxy, and we can show that. And maybe I will show that later on. And then blue shifted, there are several additional components that change. So the black is the first spectrum, the red is the second spectrum. There's a very significant drop here. So there is more absorption at 14 days than at 2 days before maximum. And now we'll begin to play a game. I will show you the data, and you will try to say that what I'm saying is wrong, and that there is some other explanation for all of that stuff. Yeah, yeah. So let me start up this game. You're saying, well, maybe this is instrumental, you know.
There are these little changes over
here.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you very much. So, well, you would say, okay, there's lots of sodium in our atmosphere. Maybe these are all kinds of telluric features. People are doing experiments with lasers, sodium lasers at the VLT. They're shining up at the atmosphere. They're producing all kinds of variable features. So, actually, you're right, and all of these features here actually change with time, and all of them are telluric. But Nando is a very, very careful guy, so he plotted here what you get from a standard star that was observed immediately after the supernova. And you can see that, indeed, there are features here that are telluric, and you see them also in the standard star. But this thing, which is very strong, does not appear in the standard star. This is the weak line here. There's a line like this, which is difficult to show for every one of the observations, and there are no features here. Okay, so it doesn't come from our atmosphere. And then you can say, well, maybe it's not from the atmosphere. Maybe it's something instrumental. You didn't calibrate so well. There's a strong line here. Maybe there's some atmospheric line. Well, one good thing about the sodium lines is that there are two of them. So if there's some instrumental effect, it should probably appear on one of them, but not on the other, and they are extremely well resolved in this high resolution spectrum. So here we plot the D1 and the D2 line, and you can see that they are identical in any epoch. So whatever is going on in sodium lines, not just in some specific wavelength region, but in both of them in the same way. No, no, the red line, as you can see from the higher signal, from the lower signal to noise, has been rescaled to fit the black line, because there is, I think, 1-to-3 ratio. Right, the ratio. So actually, I don't know whether the scaling was exactly by 3, but I can check that. That what? Right, these are not saturated, and the saturated component is saturated, and therefore it doesn't matter by how much you multiply it, as Bill has noted. I'll get to that in just a second. Okay, so one thing I'd like to take from this slide, and we will get no further if you don't agree, is that the sodium line really do change. Okay, I think it's a pretty good observational statement. They change with time. Whether or not it's related to the supernova, well, we can argue about that later. But I think they really do change. Oh no, because there are several components here, so some of them get stronger, but with time, some of them actually get weaker. So if it would have been much easier to explain if all of them got stronger all the time. Okay, and then there's a complex structure, and thank you, Ed, for that question. So Nando assigned 4 components here, A, B, C, and D. This is quite arbitrary. You could claim, well, maybe there's another component E, here or somewhere. It doesn't really matter because we aren't trying to make a real model of the exact structure of the gas clouds that are responsible for these absorptions. So for the sake of description, we have four components. Maybe there are only three, maybe there are 16, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. All of these components are relatively weak. They're not saturated like the big disk component that we see here. And to demonstrate this, I'm plotting here the CN molecular lines, the sodium lines, and the calcium lines. And you see that right at the systemic velocity of the disk, which we claim is traced by this very mildly saturated molecular line, you see this very strong and rather symmetric component, which comes from the disk of M100. It actually, the velocity fits what you expect from the model of the galaxy, assuming that the supernova is on the other side. Okay, so those are complex structure of lines, and these are blue shifted. So something that's absorbing is between us and the supernova moving towards us. Okay. So, okay, now to the tricky part. What can this be? Well, there are several possible explanations, and what immediately people think about is think, well, it doesn't have anything to do with supernova. Supernova is just a distant beacon, and something is happening between us and the supernova. And all of us had all kinds of ideas, what could this be? And I sort of listed a few of them. Well, maybe there's a moving cloud getting into the line of sight, more extinction, getting out of the line of sight, more absorption, less absorption, and so on. Also, the supernova is actually expanding. The photosphere is getting bigger in the sky. If you have a small cloud that has the same angular size or similar to the photosphere, you can have a different covering function with time, and then you can have something that goes, becomes stronger and then weaker. And my idea that was, I thought, even more elegant was that you can actually have a sheet with patches, and the patch size could be very small, because it's difficult to make a small cloud that is also thick enough to make such a strong absorption. But if you have a patchy sheet, and then the photosphere expands in the background, you can have almost whatever you want. When the photosphere become very big, much larger than the patches, you'd get something like the covering fraction of the sheet. So all of these things can happen, and you can also invent your own favorite line of sight effect. But there were several arguments why this is not the case. So let's go through it. First, there's a temporal coincidence. The strength of the line changes close to the peak flux of the supernova. And then after 60 days, between 60 and 120 days, it was constant. This would probably be some sort of argument against a moving cloud, because you'd say, how did the cloud know to move right when the supernova was at peak, and then move out and stay out? But it doesn't. That's why I invented this thing with the patchy sheet, because if you have something that has to do with the photosphere, and then it tends to a constant value when you have a very large photosphere, that would explain naturally why you would see most of the variation when the photosphere is small, so around peak, and then later on you'd see nothing. So that's not a very convincing argument. Then you can say, well, it's very difficult to make using interstellar processes variability on such short time scales. We know that, for example, in our galaxy, absorption in line of sight of stars change, but not on the time scales of weeks, but on the time scales of years. Well, I also did some reading in the literature. It's not impossible. It's actually quite likely that there could be either some very small patches of very small clouds. I'm not sure about moving very quickly, which you'd require for a single cloud, but if you have a sheet with small patches and the supernova expands, yeah, you can do that. But then there's a strong argument. The strong argument goes like this. Whatever you have in the interstellar medium should change the lines of all elements more or less in the same manner. If the composition... Okay, and what is the...
big literature, and there's wide variation.
With time. You need something that has only sodium getting into the line of sight and then getting out of it while the calcium is constant. Okay? And this is what we show here. The sodium line changes very dramatically while the calcium lines remain exactly the same. They do not change by a little bit. They don't change at all. Okay? So, yes, if you have a cloud or a patch in a sheet, that is very rich in sodium and very poor in calcium, fine, you can do that. Yeah, but why would the ionization change with time?
Only that you have different ionization amounts in different...
So one patch would be more ionized than the other patch.
Maybe. No, that's a very blind site. It's the same calcium or they're very different. So all you need to do is change the mix of those that you're seeing.
Right. So you have to have two patches that are one by one, and they are very different in the strength of light. Yeah, I agree with that. If you have, but they have to really be on the same line of sight to the same supernova, and the angular difference is very small because it's the change in the photon. Yes. Okay. But if you agree to that, then I agree.
Well, are you assuming any minimal distance to the actual supernova that might off behind it, or are you just completely unrelated?
What to these clouds? This is not constraint, well, it's in the same galaxy. But the difference in velocity is something like 70 kilometers per second. So you can place it most anywhere in the galaxy, right? It's not high velocity with respect to the supernova.
And you're assuming these components A, B, C, and D remain at the same velocity? I mean, they're
yes.
Moving at velocity, that's a strength.
Right, yes. And I think this is, well, it's a plausible explanation of the data, right? Okay. So, given the caveat that there could be, and then this is another demonstration that the calcium doesn't change, but you're already convinced, right? So, if it's not that, then it has to be something on the line of sight from the supernova to us. There would be several absorbing systems, and the difference then would be interpreted, as you said, because of the difference in ionization. Well, with the radiation from the supernova ionizing the sodium in these nearby clouds, but not changing the calcium very much because the ionization energy is very high, or much higher than sodium.
What if there was an ionizing source
before the supernova?
Right.
Yeah, so a massive star.
Well, no, I mean, if this was a double degenerate, and the supersonic source, for example,
okay.
Doing some ethics prior to the explosion, and we don't know enough about how these things operate to know whether that would have been just prior to the explosion, or perhaps some time earlier, 10 years earlier.
Okay. But then why would it change after the supernova exploded?
Would not change. I mean, it would just be setting up initial conditions.
Ah, yeah.
It would be a different set of initial
conditions. Yeah, that's possible. And so the interpretation you would like to adopt, if you think this has to do with, well, that this variable absorption has anything to do with the supernova, is that you have an absorbing cloud, it has sodium and calcium in it, and then the supernova goes off, there's lots of UV radiation, at least in the it flash ionizes the sodium, but not the calcium, because it's not hard enough. And then the sodium recombines, and you see the lines become stronger, as Bob said. And you can calculate more or less what sort of physical conditions you require. So you need a relatively high density of electrons to get the time scales you see. And the distance would have to be sort of like typical for these things, 10 to the 17 centimeters. And then from this you can calculate, assuming it's a thin shell and that there's hydrogen there with a solar ratio to sodium, you can calculate that the mass of hydrogen would be something like that, 10 to the minus 4 solar masses. And then you can say, well, why don't we see H-alpha? So you can calculate the expected H-alpha flux, and it's weak. We wouldn't have detected it, even with this very high signal-to-noise, high-resolution spectrum. So the fact that we don't see H-alpha is not a problem. The sodium absorption lines are a much more sensitive probe of intervening material than H-alpha emission. But, as nobody said, but I will say, photoionization alone cannot explain what we see in the lines, because some of the components become stronger, but others become stronger and then weaker. Okay? So you would expect flash ionization and then recombination, and it becomes stronger and stronger until it saturates. If it becomes stronger again, then it requires another source of ionization, and then, well, you can think that especially the nearest shells could be reionized by interaction with the ejector of the supernova, which will have enough time to catch up with the nearest shells. So, yes, I agree. It's a pretty convoluted model, but this is the model we put forward. So, and this is a specific model for what could make such set of observations, and I think this one specifically was mostly designed by Phil. And the idea here is that you have a red giant mass donor, it has a slow wind, and then the white dwarf has these successive nova shells emitted before the explosions, and these compress the wind and makes these, well, shells that are at different velocities, and the velocities are much slower than what the typical velocities of nova shells, because they're the nova shells are slowed down by expanding into the wind of the red giant. And then Phil calculated all of that, and in order for the thing to work, you have to be in a non-spherical regime where most of the mass loss is going into the preferred plane of the binary system, and there the nova shells are slowed by a lot. If you look at the other directions, the nova shells will not be slowed almost at all. Increases?
And you have this truncated multi-shell model and photoionization of it. Is that what you think?
Yes.
Well, how does the line get stronger?
That's easy. How does it get weaker is the complicated. You ionize it and then it recombines. When it recombines, it becomes stronger.
Oh, wow.
Right. The problem is how to get it weaker again after it got stronger. This is, I think, okay. Or else, if you don't like the thing with the nova component, you can just say the red giant has an inhomogeneous wind. It emits not a continuous wind, but these sort of shells. Why? Well, I don't know. Oh, the nova shells would be very, very fast. This was, the velocity here was between 0 and, let's say, 100 kilometers per second. A nova shell would be way higher velocity. You need something to slow the nova shell down. No. Yes, yes. The limit, it's actually showed in the paper. I didn't have the slide here. But there are pre-explosion limits on the brightness of single stars at this location, which are about -7. So you could have seen a supergiant, but not a giant. And then this model has a specific prediction that not all supernovae 1A, if all of them have the same sort of system, will show this. But you have to see this thing, you have to look relatively close, not right at the binary plane, but relatively close, so maybe this covers 20 to 30% of the sky, where you see through the shells, through the slow shells, and the red giant wind. And if you look on the polar direction, you probably wouldn't see anything, because there's nothing to compress the and slow down the polar shell. In any case, whatever model you think of, and there's another model that Nomoto's group is promoting, but I'm not on the paper, so I don't know what it is exactly. All of these models would involve a single degenerate system. So you have to have a mass donor that would give you all these gas.
Can you go deep enough to see that donor now?
Yes. Yes. Once the supernova is faint, you have to wait, you know, a few years. If HST is still there and has a sensitive camera, it's a, let's see, yeah, you can get to the depth required to get to.
So the valley field?
No.
Is this really a contradiction that maybe decades from now?
I'm not sure about how bright the supernova remnant would be, because a red giant is not that, you know, could be like magnitude zero. So what would be the supernova remnant magnitude? Fades away. So yeah, possibly you can see it, if it's not being disrupted by the explosion.
And it's behind the supernova.
Yes. Well, the extinction is about one magnitude in V. So it's not right. So if you look in I band or something like that to look at the red giant. Yeah. Okay. The way the sensitivity of the instrument is, I think the your band of choice is probably I band. You lose, you know, you gain by the for a giant in J band, but you lose by sensitivity, especially for HST, which is more or less.
I was thinking of pre-existing.
Ah, yeah. I don't know if any deep. It had to be really deep in infrared imaging.
For the HST, that was of course the key project for the vacuum.
Right. So the key project images actually missed the location by something like 10 pixels or something. I don't remember. The only relevant HST data is post-explosion ACS data. You're a very nice audience. Okay. So caveats. Okay, we'll get to that immediately. Well, first caveat is this real? Maybe there's some. I said it's weird. Bob thinks it's, you know, all of it. You know, it's usual. Whatever. Some structure in the ASM that can produce this without being related to the supernova at all. Maybe. Easy way to test, look at five more supernovae. Not all of them will have weird ISM, I think we all agree. yeah, we'll see. Well, you can choose ones that have very little extinction, right? And then you don't expect to see anything, any of them. Second thing is, well, let's say we're right. Maybe it's just a weirdo, right? This one was a red supergiant with nova shells and whatever, but all the other ones are double degenerates. So again, you have to look at a few more to convince yourself this is the explosion mechanism and not a explosion mechanism. And then both can be tested by further observations as the... Right, so existing data sets actually are very limited. And this is shown here because high-resolution observations of supernovae are not very easy to get, or at least were not very easy to get until quite recently, and even now it's not very easy. So we know of no other supernova that has multiple epoch high-resolution spectroscopy. Well, 87A is not a type 1A supernova.
No, but you could look at it in detail.
Yes. Yes. And, well, if you include 87A, if you include core collapse, there's another one, that's 98S, and it does show variable sodium absorption. And that more or less makes sense because 98S was a type 2A, and we know that there was huge mass loss before the explosion, so it's not very, very surprising that you see structure in the CSN. 87A, we also actually know that, right? There is structure in the CSN, so that's not surprising either. For type 1As, it's more interesting. Well, it's also interesting. So Nando dug up these two spectra that were taken by the ESO group going back many years ago of 91T and 98ES. And what he saw was surprisingly that there was very similar structures in those two supernovae. Not identical, of course, you wouldn't expect the same shell structure, but very suggestive. Additional components, all of them blue shifted, more or less the same velocities. Okay, that looks very nice. We have no variability here, so we don't know whether it's just interstellar or whether it changes with time. But
he had a fairly large line of sight extinction as well.
Yeah, you can see that here.
I don't remember what 98 had.
I would bet it also had, right? Because this there's an almost saturated sodium component here. So both of those had lots of dust. But those are the ones that we have right now, or when we did this thing. So the paper, which I have here, and you can then look at it, doesn't go on to say, well, all of them are the same. But there's definitely something we can test here, right? if it's this aspherical model, you expect that, well, at least some of them, maybe one in five or one in three, will have a similar structure, even if you had one spectrum. Because 0.6x always had structure, whether it varied with time or not. In every epoch you would have looked at, you would have seen some blue shifted structure. So, on the other hand, if you look at 100 and only three of them show, and all of them with very strong saturated components, you would say, okay, this has to do with the things having lots of dust, right? So if we look at a lot of additional ones, we will know. So.
Yeah, because the fact that the blue component is just a coincidence with the fact that all these decays should be on the other side.
Right.
Of course, it's annoying, if not.
Right. That's true. That's a good point. So, I'm coming to the last few slides. So what next? Okay, so we need more examples. So right now we're working on this this supernova, 07AF. We tried to get a DD approved for the VLT again, but this time it didn't go through because all the TRO time was taken by GRB observations. Something stupid like that, I don't know. But we're getting data anyway, so we got, when the supernova was very bright, Brian Penpreis observed it with the Apache Point high resolution spectrograph, and then Craig Wheeler and companions got a spectrum at HAT, which I haven't seen yet, so I don't know how good it is, and then just the week before we got a good spectrum with KEC, that so Wall Sargent tells me, shows some interesting structure in the sodium line. But I don't have it yet, so I can't show it to you. This is the supernova. It's another nearby supernova in a nice Virgo galaxy. This one has, as far as I know, less extinction. It's not highly extinguished like 0.6x. What we're doing, we already started actually, is getting single epoch snapshots of supernova, right? Because these things with the time evolution, you can do only for 13 magnitude supernovae, because you should be able to observe them as they decay. But if you just want to get at peak magnitude and you're willing to invest a lot of KEC time, you can get tens of them. You can do 16, 17 magnitude supernovae, and these are very common. So we convinced, I hope we convinced our TAC that on any given KEC night, we will have enough type 1a supernovae that will be bright enough to get, fill the night, and then using something like three nights, we should get 20 supernovae 1a. Every one of them only for a single epoch, but this telltale structure on the blue side should be in all of them, or in some of them, or in none of them, and we'll be able to tell the difference. And of course, looking at supernovae with low extinction is interesting because these are less likely to have interstellar components, and also because if this thing is true, you should be able to see also very even slower material, which is now masked by the saturated absorption from the galaxy. Right? If you, there could be a 5 km/s component or 10 km/s, what you would expect from the red super red giant wind without being compressed. So this is interesting to look. So you're hoping to get some more KEC time or more KEC data. Well, this is getting more difficult because I don't think we have on any given night enough. Okay. Good. So with this in mind, I also proposed for a TRO time on KEC with high res to do exactly that. So to select a few, not 20, let's say maybe 3 or 2, good supernovae that are bright enough and to be suitable. And for those, we can do the real test. Oh, I think I'll get all of it. And just to finish off with some core collapse supernovae, this is what an H-alpha profile of a type 2 supernova looks at high resolution. These are things we observed when we didn't have any type 1As. So it takes four orders of high res to cover the H-alpha profile. And you see that we get very nice signal to noise. And there's actually interesting structure here that I'm talking about with Roger Chevalier. So these are type 2s, and this is a type 2N, which has very interesting structure, which I don't know exactly what it means right now, but it's very interesting. Yeah, this is nice. Yeah, yeah, but you can actually measure the mass. Yeah. Yeah. So thanks.
Hydrogen that would be ripped off that we've seen at various times in the post-supernova spectrum.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you take a look at the post-supernova spectrum in the source that you did look at.
We have very strong limits on H-alpha, on hydrogen.
Can you compare them with this? Of course, for a giant donor, it does depend on the distance.
Right.
Maybe one needs to sample that space more finely.
Yes.
Maybe there's something about the calculations that change, I don't know. Have you made the comparison?
No, we didn't make the comparison. And the reason is that the Marietta paper, at least on the face of it, is already in contradiction with the radio limits, in strong contradiction. So if there's so much hydrogen, it should have been seen in the radio. So the limits you get from hydrogen absorption are three orders of magnitude weaker than what you get from radio, unless we don't understand radio at all. So right now, it's an interesting problem, but I'm not sure where the problem is. Is there a problem in the Marietta calculations? Is there a problem in how we understand radio? Or if this is the case, then it's really interesting to look in the optical, because the optical is less sensitive than the radio.
Talking about material
slamming into whatever structures there before in the ISM. Well, if you put. Can the genesis of these two things be different than you're testing? Well, I'm a little bit out of my depth here because I'm not an expert on radio modeling. But what I sort of gather from our experience with GRVs and other things is that the radio is sensitive to whatever's in the way, right? The supernova slams into, mass loss from the donor itself, whatever. And then it emits in radio. It's rather straightforward. There is argument between the two fractions, right? Whether it's free absorptions or whether it's synchrotron SSA. But as Alicia showed in the line, the differences are minor in this specific scenario. So the difference is by a factor of a few, not three orders of magnitude. So I don't know. I think there's a problem here. I also have no way to evaluate the Marietta paper on the theoretical size. Is this like a solid prediction, or is it like some sort of arguable thing? And maybe some other people can comment on that.
Yeah, well, on that specific atomic flow, a single last week, I was talking to him about he's redone this Marietta calculation. He finds something different, like less observable hydrogen and so on.
Okay.
Could all the hydrogen be ionized after this enormous bump of the supernova shell into the companion? Could it be that it's all ionized hydrogen that you might not see?
Well, even then you should see at least some emission lines.
You still see it.
Yeah, the emission lines. You can do it with absorption, but you see the emission lines.
On the comment in a second, you mentioned weird ISM. It is probably instructive to look at. The ISM is weird, and every line of sight is different dust to gas, different elemental ratios, and in the galaxy, people have used that to actually map out the ISM. So they look at bright stars dissolving in sodium doublet, and they see all these nice velocity components. You can map out the rotation curve.
Right.
So there is actually a lot of weird ISM, and there's a lot of interesting and strange-looking clouds.
Yeah. Actually, on the paper, we have some people that actually are experts on this thing, and they still think it's. Yeah, there are. There actually, I think the. they're the eighth autos or something like that.
But if you'd like to see some high velocity shells, you'd say the low velocities are a problem. You can function the geometry to slow the shells down.
Right.
But low velocities fit naturally with ISM class.
Right. Yes.
Curve. If you would find the high velocity component, that would be harder to actually.
That's true.
Realize.
Yeah.
Then you say that the change with time, you should see these things many other times around the galaxy. This is a common.
Right. The time scales for ISM.
The only thing I see in this model is that you're saying that nearby clouds that have low velocity.
Right.
That's so. Then you're arguing, or basically, an origination of those clouds.
Yeah, I fully agree.
Between ISM and something that's generated.
Oh no, no. That's a big difference. I agree.
I have local nearby ISM in clouds.
It really needs to be something like 10 to the 16 or 10 to the 17 centimeters from the supernova. So to put an ISM cloud there, I don't know, you can put it by chance, but the So we looked at the area around the supernova in the pre-explosion images and with HST. It's not a complex structure. There's no OB association nearby. There are no massive stars there. You wouldn't expect, well, it's not the obvious place to put, you know, gas and dust clouds. Is it, you know, of course it's possible. You can never have any sort of conclusive thing from one object. But, okay, we'll get two or three more.
If you just distance that you just forward to that, you'd be a flash or the dust tail.
No, the ionization. To get the ionization. Yes. Yes.
If it was purely ISM, you should also see redshift that come from.
That's true. Yes. And there are three supernovae, and all of them have blue shifted components and no redshift.
Do you know how much UV is emitted?
Ah, yeah. No, we don't know. This was a highly extinguished object. Even if we would have looked at it, let's say, with Swift or something, we wouldn't have seen it. But the paper includes estimations based on a spectrum of a supernova that someone observed, 92A, that has coverage into the UV. And from that, you get some sort of estimate or limits. Yeah. You couldn't rest a word, they say. Yeah.
Can't you derive it from the strength of the lines?
How much would you actually need to ionize?
Yeah, you can, well. The spectrum of type 1A supernova in the UV look goes like this, right? So the question of how much UV depends very, very strongly on where you, you know, what do you call UV?
5 UV.
Hmm?
Okay,
so, right, so you can, so if you assume,
right.
Okay, good question. If you assume 90, that's been done in the paper. If you assume 92A, which is the only thing that's there, You can have enough photons to ionize sodium and not to influence calcium. And it's not a big surprise because, as we said, it drops very quickly in the UV. So 11, you can have 5 EV enough and 11 EV nothing. It's not a problem.
It is interesting. You expect this to be, you know, if this is like, say, RSOPG,
yes.
Future vision of RSOPG, I mean, that's going off as a nova every 11 years or so. Right. It's emitting very soft X-ray radiation, and therefore lots of UV radiation. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine that there's some interstellar medium where you're getting a little bit maybe of material spread out, really no explosions, since the last beginning, right, so not getting rid of everything. Plus it's been irradiated episodically over this period of time. That's the conditions that you start with.
Right.
Before you even put that spectrum in, would that make any difference to the
I don't think so, because from the densities we calculate, the recombination time is rather short. It's of the order of month. So if you had 25 years ago, which is what the timescale we require for these specific shells, or 11 years ago, an X-ray, you know, episode, the gas would have time to recombine and then be re-ionized by the supernova and recombine again.
Just as it apparently has afterwards.
Yes. In this model. Yes.
I wanted to point out something related. We looked at variable absorption lines in the gamma ray burst.
Right.
And definitely this is gas not associated with the universe at all.
I remember.
Halfway across the universe, different. And we saw differences in the way the magnesium 2 and even the iron 2 vary with each other and the magnesium 1. So, it can happen. It, just from the way the clouds are distributed in the ionization.
I think, I remember this work. I agree it's very relevant. The only thing I think is that the size would be rather different because the angular size of the cloud could be much larger because you're looking so much farther away.
Well, the time scale is different too. But, maybe there's a way.
But I agree. This is the core of the problem. We haven't proven 100% or not even near there that it's not some weird or not weird something in the ice.
Do you expect this debris to run into the circumstellar material and this become a 2N?
No. This we calculated. This mass loss is thin. It's not going to, the supernova can catch up. There's not a lot of hydrogen. There's 10 to the minus 4 solar mass. It's not going to become a 2N. You're not going to see the HF.
But you said you had to have a disk of material that slows down the.
Oh yeah.
And doesn't that eventually have to get run into?
No, because the Nova Chains themselves do not have a lot of mass. 2Ns have solar masses of ejecta. This thing has orders of magnitude less. So the strength of the H alpha line is going to be much, much weaker.
Not only have the Nova shells, you also have the wind of the red giant.
Right. So to slow the Nova shell significantly, the mass of the gas should be comparable to the mass of the Nova shell, right? So if it was spherical.
Or more.
Yeah, okay.
Which is easy in the red giant,
I mean, this is the same model as O2IC.
Right.
There's a delay before it actually runs in.
That's true, but with O2IC you have a lot more material.
Eventually.
Well, the red giant wind is much less massive than the, O2IC you had either an AGB star, so that's 10 to the minus 4 solar masses a year. This is 10 to the minus 4 solar masses total, 10 to the minus 8 solar masses a year, or something like that, from a red giant. Different. Or you had a symbiotic star, common envelope where you can have 10 to the minus 3 solar masses.
Well, if you assume that your
red giant projection
of 12 to minus 8, the classification from the wind,
then it only captured everything. Oh, no. Okay.
Now I see. That probably the Nova which erupted. Mm-hmm. Was eating
by the moon. Okay, now I see. I there was something I didn't understand. What you're asking is under the assumption that the red giant wind was the mass source for the white dwarf accretion. I think it's not the case because then again, this is a little bit out of my field, but. The way I understand Phil's model, he's assuming that the red giant was accreting, or the white dwarf was accreting, not from the red giant wind, but from the red giant directly through overflow. Yes. So and in addition, there's a wind from the red giant, like all red giants have winds. Okay, so it's not tied together. I agree, because then I understand you had to have accretion and going over the transverse second mass, you have to have more massive wind. Neither can have very thin.
10 to the minus 8 solar mass wind of the red giant, you only need to have this going for 10,000 years to have your 10 to the minus 4 solar mass.
Right, so maybe it's less than that. I said 10 to the minus 8 because that's the limit from the radio. It could be less than that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's easy if this phase lasts for a while. Actually build up your 10 to the minus 4 solar masses. So.
Yes.
So, I mean, it could very well be that the red giant wind is more massive than that. I mean, the amount of material that's hanging there is more massive. Which
I don't think so. I don't think so. Because if the red giant was more than 10 to the minus 8 a year, you would have seen it in the radio, the wind. unless it stopped emitting a wind before the explosion. But if it was continuously losing mass four wind, the radio observations limit that constant mass loss to be less than 10 to the minus 8 kilo. I know. There is no galactic analog. Even RSOPUK is reminiscent, but it's not the same at all. I know.
And of course, it will be located at the other end of the galaxy.
If it seems like we're grilling you, it's only because it's such interesting results.
That's fine. I had the same sort of doubts and questions.
Getting close.
Are there any more questions now, or do I
think you offline? If this model is correct, you require the nova shells to be slowed down quite significantly. Would you expect in other systems we've seen pretty strong variations in the velocities of the absorption lines? Because you showed this tentative evidence that it's all, you know, the first one's at minus 50 kilometers per second. I would expect if it's a fine-tuning problem, which suggest that the spread is going to be large.
Yes, I agree. I had the same sort of thing. I was saying, this looks too good. You know, how come all the components are the same velocity? It almost seems contrived. I exactly know what you mean. It's here. Here.
Yeah.
The alignment is just too good.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have no explanation.
Sodium isotope.
Yeah.
It's easy to find out that because there anyone saying that something, you know, 200 kilometers the other side with sodium absorption. So that we don't look for that.
We already have additional data, and so first of all, we didn't see any high velocity components so far. We looked at several supernovae. So we don't see. Actually, we began looking for high velocity components for a different reason. Look for high velocity clouds in these other galaxies, but we didn't see any. So we don't see any of those. And
in their last spectrum, are they all weakening by that again, or if you look at some components that are stronger and weaker?
Well,
do they all become?
No, weakening? They become in that object. Here. Yeah, I'm sorry. poor selection of colors. But the last three spectra are essentially identical. They go into a steady state, which is, and the steady state for some lines is stronger than initially, but for other components it's weaker than initially. So I would have been much happier if everything was going down and you would say, okay, here are shells A, B, C, and D, and this one is ionized, and this one is ionized. It's not that simple, and I would have expected the ones that are closer to the explosion to be higher velocity than the ones that are farther away, because those have been slowed by more. It doesn't obey any sort of, I tried to play with such, like a toy model, it doesn't describe observations. The observations need, you know, are more complicated.
Questions, and I want to thank you.